Jerusalem for the festival of the Passover. When he was 12 years old, they went up to the festival according to the custom. After the festival was over, while his parents were returning home, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem, but they were unaware of it. Thinking he was in their company, they traveled on for a day. Then they began looking for him among their relatives and friends. When they did not find him, they went back to Jerusalem to look for him. After 3 days, they found him in the temple courts, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. Everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding and his answers. When his parents saw him, they were astonished. His mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us like this? Your father and I have been anxiously searching for you." "Why were you searching for me?" he asked. "Didn't you know I had to be in my father's house?" But they did not understand what he was saying to them. Then he went down to Nazareth with them and was obedient to them. But his mother treasured all these things in her heart. And Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. The word of the Lord.
Kids are invited to kids' church with Kelly today.
Mary treasured these things in her heart. This is the call for us, too, as we come to worship in light of the miracle of the incarnation, the celebration of God with us, the creation anew again with what Christ has done, to treasure these things in our hearts. I like to think about that as sort of a reminder for the reader if you're reading Luke's gospel for the first time, perhaps it's a reminder for the reader to also ponder and treasure these things in their hearts as they're going through the story, as they're seeing it all again. And in this season of Christmas, I'm always reminded of how much I could take in to treasure and ponder in my heart as we then move to Epiphany season next, Lent, and then Easter season to sort of treasure these things up. But this morning service, the first reading, Jonathan started off with Psalm 148, which is read often at Easter and almost every Christmas day according to the lectionary, and it has pretty much everything. This is the list: praising the Lord, angels, heavenly hosts, sun, moon, stars, heaven, sea creatures, ocean depths, lightning, hail, snow, clouds, winds, mountains, hills, fruit trees, cedars, wild animals, cattle, small creatures. I like that general category. Small creatures, birds, kings, princes, rulers, young men, young women, old men, children. Everything is gathered up in this praise. I don't know where I first heard it, but somebody spoke of this psalm as sort of an ecology of praise, that everything joins in this singing, that we are lifted up and outside of ourselves. And this, the first Sunday of Christmas season, next Sunday is the second Sunday of Christmas season, is a good time to remember, what does it mean to reverberate with praise? What does it mean to see creation hum in that way, to have praise be a part of who we are? And I'm often reminded, when we get to super happy psalms or super sad psalms, the advice of Dietrich Bonhoeffer is that when you're happy, to pray the sad psalms, and when you're sad, to pray the happy psalms. And I think to look at this one, there's a scaffolding, I'm trying to think of the right term, a probability sort of thing, that you could read this psalm today and imagine, but if you were sad, how would you pray it? Because it would give you the resources, I think, if you could imagine that when that day comes. And when you're assigned with these sad psalms, what would that look like to pray and find solidarity when you're in joy? Today is Christmas morning, so despite of all the sorrows that we may carry in our hearts, we're still called into joy again. We're called to reverberate with our praise, and oftentimes in the scripture, to see beyond the limits of our own creation and selves, to see wider into the world than we can see at the moment. And that can lift us up in other ways. And so we join in the praise that all these things bring about. There was a recent interview with the historian Tom Holland, who recently became a Christian. He was I don't think he would say he was ever an atheist, but an agnostic historian for a long time, and became a Christian in the last couple of years. He wrote a book that was, some of you might have seen, called Dominion, which is about sort of how most of what we appreciate in the West, this was before he was a Christian, came about because the Christians won. For instance, if you were to look for human rights under a microscope scientifically, you wouldn't find anything. But the victory of human rights as sort of a common good that it's in the UN Charter is an example of Christians, the Christian idea of the individual worth and dignity of each person. So a lot of these things that sort of we take for granted in the world, he argues, comes from the development of Christianity. This, over the last 2 years, led him into becoming a Christian. But I loved this question at the end of the interview as it was taking place near Christmas. What does Christmas mean to you? The time of year where I feel the most Christian and I feel that I can believe most easily are Christmas and Easter, because these are the two great festivals of the church. I respond to the inherent beauty and drama of the story. And to live in England in December, or to live in the canyon in Glenwood Springs, is to live in darkness a lot of the time. And so the idea of light and darkness is very vivid for me. I can't speak for everyone, but I find myself near to Holland here in expressing that Christmas and Easter are these times in which you can relax into belief, I think. Because the church's joy and the church's mystery and the inherent beauty and the drama of the story seems to overcome in those moments for me. It also reminds me of the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor, who says that, you know, for the ancient person, when you're celebrating Good Friday, April 10th, let's say, in 400 AD, they actually believed that they were closer to Good Friday, 33 AD, hypothetically, when Jesus dies, than if they had celebrated any other day closer, you know, April 9th in 200 AD, that there's this matching up of sort of the days that we don't have as sort of the secularism has won, but sort of like when we celebrate Easter or Christmas, we're sort of brought into days that seem to radiate beyond their scope. So much so that when I celebrated, so much so that like if I were to say I want to celebrate the incarnation, I think randomly in February 10 years ago, for some reason I feel closer to that day when I celebrate Christmas with the church and its wisdom today, that it magnifies in that way and how we can sort of grow into that. And so the psalm for us draws us into that praise that takes over creation and reverberates throughout this. And it's here worth remembering that with the list of praise that we saw, that what God does in Jesus Christ touches everything. I know some people, I don't think many people here, but some people grew up with a very bifurcated sort of only go to heaven is the point. All of this is lost. All of this has no meaning. But it's like, how do you pray Psalm 148 if that's the case? How do you see that all of these things that God also created are caught up in joy? And that could bring about this reminder of what does it mean that we're looking forwards, and what we see in Christ is sort of this refashioned new heavens and new earth rather than the obliteration of everything. That praise can radiate in creation in that way, can draw us to the fact that God's work magnifies throughout creation. It's the Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann who also said that when humans praise, we have this sort of lyrical self-abandonment. We have this lyrical self-abandonment. We have this abandonment to ourselves as we praise. And as we sing, too, which is what connects this reading to Colossians, is that singing that's spoken of in the book of Colossians, that we sort of have to abandon our own places in this to sort of magnify with that praise. Singing in praise to God in particular calls us to some self-abandonment of the way in which we think things should go, that we found ourselves caught up in a bigger and wider story. The reading from Colossians that Nola read for us, talked about this. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and beloved, clothe yourself with compassion, kindness, humility, and gentleness, and patience. In the previous verse, which we didn't read because it's Christmas, there's a list of things you are supposed to take off. Some common things. Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature: sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed, which is idolatry. Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming. You used to walk in these ways in the life you once lived, but now you must rid yourself of all such things as these: anger, rage, malice, slander, and filthy language from your lips. Do not lie to each other, since you have taken off your old self with its practices and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in the knowledge in the image of its creator. Here there is no Gentile, no Jew, circumcised, uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, or free, but Christ is all and is in all. And that's where this verse picks up. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly beloved, clothe. As Christ came into the manger and takes up residency in the world, we talked about this a couple Sundays ago with St. S. and Athanasius to some degree, is that humanity is then fused with the image of God again, that Christ sits in our stead, and the painting that which we have marred in the fall is redrawn. And so what Paul in Colossians is sort of advocating is, because of that, you can take off the patterns of life that you used to live in. You can undress yourself from those things. And then you can pick up and clothe yourself in these virtues which Christ has reopened to us in the world. You can clothe yourself above all in love, he says. And it's interesting to me because there was a time in my life where I worked at McDonald's. Twice, actually. But the second time I worked at a 1950s one, and you had to dress ridiculously to do it and wear one of those paper hats. And I wanted to die every day. It was a dark time. But there was something about, I was able to gain something in my mind about what does it mean to clothe yourself? Like when I clothed myself in that uniform, one, I was sort of making myself, in my hometown, an object of ridicule, but also taking on a job to some degree, taking on a performance, taking on a way of being in the world. And in taking on that way of being in the world, McDonald's is not Chick-fil-A levels of kindness and this, that, and the other, but you take on being sort of a human resources thing, of caring for people, of meeting people in their need. It's at that time in my life I realized that one of the downfalls of modern America is drive-thrus, because it basically kills all human relationship at that time. It's like, here's your Diet Coke, bye. Even if you see pain in the person, you don't have the time to interact because there's literally a car behind them, and you have to just move on to the next one. But we have these times, you could think of athletics, which if I were smarter, would not have made myself seem so miserable by picking the example I did. I played football once. That we have these things in which we clothe ourselves, and identity comes with them, and practices come with them. And so what Paul is advocating, if we think about it that way, is this way of which we can take off those things in which we are entrapped in and put on Christ, put on something that lifts us up and enables us to live new lives in virtue. Put on compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. To be those who can bear with each other and forgive one another if anyone has a grievance to give us. Forgive as the Lord has forgiven us. And put on the virtue of love, which binds them all in perfect community. And let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, since as members of one body you were called to peace and to be thankful. And then let the message of Christ dwell richly as you teach and admonish one another with wisdom through the psalms, hymns, and songs of the Spirit, singing to God with gratitude in your heart. Singing to God with thankfulness in who we are. And whatever you do, do it all in word and deed, in the name of Lord Jesus Christ, giving thanks to the Father through him. As we're invited to put on Christ, there's a little bit of which, at the end of this, it seems like Paul is saying, you can't really take it off either as you've been baptized into this. Whatever you do, do it with Christ. So going to work at McDonald's, I could make the conscious decision to sort of put that on and go out into the world. But as we've been baptized, we belong to that sphere. Whether we're awake to that we have put on Christ, or whether we're putting on the words and past deeds, those things which lead to death, which have bound us before, is a different thing. But we have put that on. It was recently in a baptism at my last church. One of the kids was getting baptized, wanted to wear an article of clothing that expressed sort of his personal identity that might have offended other people too. But I also had to sit with them and explain to them that the early church, in their wisdom, would have you completely disrobe yourself and enter into the waters and come out of baptism on the other side and clothe yourself again in a new robe, white as you went out. And like, as it cool as a personal expression of identity might be at your baptism, what you're really doing on that day is taking on a story much bigger and grander. It's not for you to take on, I'll pick on myself, or I were like, I wanted to wear a Cubs shirt into the baptismal waters. It's that type of identity I might actually be being asked to strip off. Because as we come out of the waters, putting on our new identities brings out a different thing. Which brings us to the story of Samuel and Jesus here, because both of them in different ways are sort of given up to tasks that are not their own tasks. Samuel's mother prayed for a child and promised to dedicate him to the Lord before he was born. You could see many psychologists for that today. My mother had sworn me to God before I was even born. So much so that she dropped me off at the temple, and that became my life and my work. Talk about overcoming somebody's autonomy and self-expression. Jesus, too, as he's brought to the temple, is brought up in this religious way with his parents, again, Mary pondering her heart, that there's an identity here that overrides whatever their wishes might be for their child. This is why I think often of those New Testament teaching, some of the hardest in the gospel about whether you must hate your mother, your brother, your father, this, is that oftentimes the people, unfortunately, that will most inhibit us into walking the path we have to walk with God are the people who love us the most. Might even love us as Christian parents. But to say, son, I sent you to college and I paid for that, and then I worked with you as you went through medical school and this, that, and the other, and now you've decided to be a missionary in Africa. It was not what me and your mother had envisioned in our lives. Or to pick up my twin brother for an instance, he gets sober, loses his job, cashes out his 401k, finds God, and decides to live on the streets among the poor of San Francisco for a couple nights randomly, which would terrorize my mother. And my mother's a good Christian mom, and she knew that this might have been the call of Jesus Christ, but it did not make her any happier that this was the choice he was making with his life. To find himself in the lowest pits, in depths of despair, connecting with those people, bringing them food, spending his savings doing that. It's at these moments where we find the people closest to us who love us might think better options are available than the one that God holds forth for us. And this isn't to say that, you know, you need to find your own way of these extreme acts that I bring up, but that the life that we have in forgiveness, there are times when we're being asked to forgive by the church, by other Christians, in which somebody near you might say that you're exposing yourself to risk or abuse again. And this is, there are times where that's true, but there's also times where the New York Times had a well-torn apart article this past summer about the danger of forgiveness and how it can't be offered easily, as if we live in a world run amok with forgiveness all the time. You know, if there's one thing I'd say that characterizes American society, it's the spirit of generosity and forgiveness that we embody. That's a joke. We don't have runaway forgiveness causing amok in our streets. All that connecting to both these readings from Samuel and Luke, which really play off each other very well, as they're both sort of brought to the temple at young age. Samuel left there to train as a priest. And Christ, as he's brought there, first in the story right before this, in which he is circumcised at the temple, which is, I think, Luke's way of saying that Jesus Christ's body is inscribed with the story of Israel. When we went through the book of Leviticus, it was hard to find New Testament texts that really fit over the 14 weeks we went through the book of Leviticus. But this one always came to mind to me as this is a Levitical command, the one in which they bring him to the temple for circumcision. And so his body is literally inscribed with that book. His book, that book becomes part of who he is through that act, as Jesus becomes sort of this faithful Jew all over again. He's the one who sort of lives out this story faithfully, as we'll see through the book of Luke. But then in the story right after this, Jesus' parents bring him to the temple again. And temple is a common word in the early parts of the book of Luke. It's temple, it's temple, it's temple. And so Jesus is brought to the temple again, and this time it's for the Passover, which is this celebration of liberation from the tyranny of Egypt, the tyranny of slavery to Pharaoh, the tyranny of all those things. And here Jesus is brought to celebrate that thing, which is inevitably what his life will become about, that Jesus brings an end to the tyranny of the tyranny and slavery to sin and death in our own lives and world, and frees us. And this is what Colossians was on. It frees us from those past patterns to put on new patterns as we sort of walk into the world renewed by Christ's image. And so they bring him to the temple for this moment, and then they leave the temple, and they cannot find Jesus. Now, many people ask, how do you lose Jesus? Now, metaphorically, as a Christian, if you would say, how do you lose faith for a time and lose Jesus? I think many of us can raise our hands and answer, I lost him when I got too busy. I lost him when I lost focus. I lost him when something else became my overarching God than the God that I had. That might be too cute, but anyways, we can lose Jesus often ourselves. But the real answer is that it's likely going to the Passover was a bunch of people coming to Jerusalem together from where Jesus and Mary were residing, or Joseph, Jesus, and Mary were residing, and they traveled in this large pack, and there'd be a front of the pack that maybe was a half a mile ahead, and the back of the pack a half a mile back, and they would move together across the time. And so Jesus, like also is 12, might be playing with other young boys somewhere in between the front and the back of the pack, or way ahead, as I would hike with my parents, way ahead, or way behind. And so the idea at this moment is, where's Jesus? He's somewhere in this group of people. So when they get to where they stop for the night and they go, where's Jesus? Which is the appropriate time to ask the question, where is your child? In this culture, maybe not in our culture, but to say we've traveled together, let's bed down in our own individual homes, family units for the night, and they realize he's not there. You have to wait till morning to sort of go back because it's a dark road. And so they wait until morning, they go back, and they search for 3 days before they find Jesus sitting in the temple. Now, 3 days, you can very clearly see there's resurrection sort of imagery that Luke's employing here. So much so that if you wanted to, one of my favorite passages from the end of the book of Luke is the road to Emmaus story. You can really overlay that some with what goes on here. Those disciples walk away after 3 days thinking they've lost Jesus. He's dead. Jesus comes and is among them. The one they mourn is present with them. And he opens and breaks the bread, and they see Jesus in the breaking the bread as he's leaving again. And their journey is away from Jerusalem. This one is returning back to Jerusalem. There's all sorts of parallels between those two stories. But 3 days later, they find him sitting in the temple. And what he says to them is, I think, at the heart of today's sermon or today's text. After 3 days, they found him in the temple court, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking questions. Everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding and his answers. And when his parents saw him, they were astonished. His mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us like this? Your father and I have anxiously been searching for you." "Why were you searching for me? Didn't you know I had to be in my father's house?" But they did not understand what he was saying to them. Jesus is one whose life is found in his father's house. He has a special bond to his parents, so much as every other person does. So, but the call, going back to that, what is the call in our lives? The call to be doing his father's work is overarching to that particular nature of his family. "Didn't you know I had to be here?" And so much so, why were you searching? I mean, in different translations, this will come off even more sort of antagonistic, of sort of like, what did you expect? This is, of course, where I had to be. That I was to be at the center of all things for us, the ritual of our centered life. I was to be in the temple doing my Father's work, being about my Father's work. And Jesus there is expressing wisdom and understanding. It's often in Luke's gospel, particularly in Luke, you'll see Jesus lounging as if a teacher. He's sort of this wise sage is a character that he sort of comes out of in Luke. In Matthew, Jesus will appear like Moses often. We start Matthew next Sunday, but Matthew till Easter, but he'll appear as Moses sort of on mounts giving sermons and this, that, and the other. In Luke, he's lounging. There's a joke about Luke that I think I've used before that he's either at a meal, going to a meal, or leaving a meal in the book of Luke to say that he's always sort of there with the people sort of discoursing about wisdom and questions and answers in the book of Luke. Here it starts at an early age. Here he is in the temple asking questions, and everyone heard him, was amazed at his understanding. But it's Jesus who's at the center of their ritual life, and in many ways, the Jewish ritual life, and in that way, respectively, some of the Christian ritual life. Didn't you know that I had to be in my Father's house? Didn't you know that I had to be back here at the temple? And it's temple that centers his ministry in Luke's gospel. There's a lot to say about what does it mean to be about the Father's business and how we find that in our own lives, learning from Jesus as we go. One of the things I think we'll end with this is this sort of paradoxical nature of Jesus here is that you lose what is nearest and dearest to you and you spend 3 days searching for it and it's right where it should be. Now, sometimes that actually happens to us. You think you put your car keys someplace else, you search your whole house, and it turns out that the hook that they're always supposed to be on is where they are. But you didn't check there first because you were convinced that you had put them someplace else. So too it is, I think, we find that we can find ourselves drawn away from what it is the Father's work often. And we'll spend days and days trying to find our way back to it. And it turns out it's right where it should be, right there in the temple, right there in the church, right there where Jesus is. And it's, where else would it be? Where else would we find that? And yet as we begin this new year with that call to praise in the book of Psalms, that disrobing and re-robing from Colossians, and the stories of Samuel and Jesus working in the temple in separate times and separate places, perhaps it's a good time for us to ask ourselves, where are we searching for these things? You know, you've lost your path, you've lost your way, you've lost some direction, and you search in many different spots. Self-help books, workout plans, new parenting techniques, different ways of being gracious, different ways of being in charge, different ways of this. And for us to take time like Mary to ponder these things in our hearts and turn to the place where it was all along, to find ourselves bound to our incarnation in Jesus and God with us again. So let us pray. You have invited us into the praise of creation this Christmas morn. The praise that reverberates through all of it we heard in the psalm. And may we lift our voices and praise you again this Sunday and the next as we remain in this Christmas season and take time to celebrate you are Emmanuel, God with us. May we find ourselves grafted into new patterns of taking off the old ways of being and re-robing ourselves in the virtues and love that you have in store for us. And so as we go searching about in our lives,